Welcome to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast, the podcast for serious lacrosse players and their supporters to help further their development and navigate their way throughout their lacrosse careers. And now, here are your hosts, New England Lacrosse Journal's Kyle Devitt and Jack Piatelli.
Welcome to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast. I'm your host, Kyle Devitt. Alongside me, the man, the myth, the legend, Mr. Jack Piatelli. Jack, how we doing?
Fantastic. Couldn't be better. You know, looking forward to a lot of lacrosse this weekend. Some great Ivy League games coming up, NESCAC games. And it's always a pleasure to be with you, Kyle.
Yeah, I am back in studio.
Makes my day. Yeah, it's nice to have you back in studio. You got a little sick there with the COVID, so you're healthy. You look good. Looks like you got a haircut.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's my refresh. Joining us today is the new coach, assistant coach of the PLL Chrome, Matt Couric. Coach, how are we doing?
I'm doing extremely well. Thank you for having me on, guys. I'm looking forward to it.
And we should say also former Cornell coach. I mean, do you want me to list all of the places you've coached? Because we might be here for a while.
It is pretty lengthy. I mean, I've been around the block for sure. But yeah, you know, I mean, I had a great run at some wonderful places, and the people that I've met and the experiences I had, it was just incredible. At Hobart and Jacksonville and Georgetown and obviously at Cornell. So it was a lot of jumping around, and certainly would like to stay at a couple of places, maybe a little bit longer, looking back at some decisions that I made. But, you know, the grass is always greener, but I've had an unbelievable career and loved every minute of it.
And coach, you were the Patriot Coach of the Year in 2002. You were the Division III Coach of the Year in 1997, and you're also the Super Six Lacrosse League Coach of the Year in 1996. So you've got quite the resume, having success at the college level. But what's very impressive to me is what a great student athlete you were at Hobart. You were a two-time All-American and four-time national champion at Hobart, captain as well. But you also played 4 years of ice hockey and captained the hockey team. We go way back. We met at the San Diego State summer camp in 1990-91, and we haven't lost touch. John Tillman was at that camp. I think Billy Day, Jock, your assistant coach, the defensive corner for the Chrome, was present. That camp really opened my eyes to the national scene of lacrosse and coaching. It was a great experience. Tell the story that you told me. Your parents went to Cornell.
Yeah.
And you had the opportunity to go to Cornell, but you decided on Hobart. Why? Because I think it's important.
I don't know if that's the full truth of the story, Jack. I sat in Coach Moran's office. I was coming out of Irondequoit High School up in Rochester, New York, and really wanted to play hockey. That was my first love, and you know, wasn't getting a ton of looks for Division I hockey as a 5'8" defenseman. You know, but I did talk to the coaches at Cornell as well, and they said they'd give me an opportunity to possibly walk on. And but I sat with Coach Moran, and this is a great story. He looked at my transcript. He's like, "Yeah, you did pretty well in school." And then he saw my SAT score, and he said, "Big boy, is this the best you got on the SAT? This is your highest score on the SAT?" I said, "Yes, sir, Coach. You know, that was my last time. I did pretty well." He's like, "A little light there, guy. You might want to look at the school up the road, Hobart College, because I know they really want you for both sports." And, you know, so he helped Coach Urich recruit me to Hobart, in all honesty. So I went to Hobart and wouldn't trade it for anything. It was the greatest experience ever, you know, four national titles with some of my best friends, and kind of helped the hockey program get from being below average to average, you know, with the group of guys I came in with there. And, you know, able to play both sports for 4 years was just awesome experience. So I wouldn't say I was, you know, into Cornell by any stretch, Jack. You know, I would have liked to. My sister went there, my parents went there, and certainly it's an amazing place, but Hobart was the right fit for me.
Coach, I think people identify Hobart now as a Division I school, a lot of people that are maybe newer to college, but You went there when it was Division III. You know, you won four consecutive D3 championships and were the MVP of the 1989 game. And then you went on to coach at Randolph-Macon. So basically, you're a D3 guy at your base.
Absolutely. All the way. So, yeah, it was a different time, Kyle, you know, and people can question back and forth. Should you know, Hobart have gone Division I? I think they should have. And the reason why we decided to go to Division I at Hobart was to keep the rivalries that program was built on, right? The oldest game in the country is the Cornell-Hobart game. And, you know, the games with Syracuse and Penn State and the Division I schedule that we basically played when I was a student athlete there, those games are going to go by the wayside, right? Because the rules were changing. So, you know, a Division I team wouldn't want to even consider playing a Division III team now, because what's the benefit of it, right? You know, if you lose it, you're in trouble, right? You should win it. So it was really to keep those rivalries strong the foundation of Hobart lacrosse was built on. So that was why we made the jump at Hobart to go Division I. But yeah, to be able to play a Division I schedule, 7, 8, 9 Division I teams every year, and then play a handful of Division IIIs, and you get to the NCAA tournament, and it kind of made for a little bit easier run for us, I guess, to be able to play Division III teams after playing all those D1 strong teams, put us in a great position to win the national title.
Matt, how many of your teammates at Hobart were like you in the sense that they were multi-sport athletes?
It was a big part of the culture and part of the deal there. We had a number of guys who played football. You know, we probably had, you know, if we had 38 guys on our roster, that's a whole different topic, right? You know, we had 35 to 40 guys, and then there was a B team with another 30 guys. You know, now these rosters are 50, 60, 70 kids at Division I. But I would say we had probably 7 or 8 football guys. Mike DiMaria, who was midfielder of the year that I played with for 4 straight years, we ran together on a line. He was one of the best middies I've ever seen. He played hoops there. He was a great basketball player there. And then probably 3 or 4 of us that played hockey as well. So I would say almost half our team were 2-sport guys in college.
Would you say the success you had winning 4 national championships was a big part of having so many 2-sport athletes?
I think so. You know, I don't know. I mean, it's a tough question. You can debate it all you want, I guess. But I feel like, you know, you're just much more well-rounded if you're playing another sport. You know, I remember it was hard for me in hockey because you'd go right from hockey, finish our season at the end of February, and thankfully games weren't played in lacrosse until usually early March at that time, right? Now guys are playing games at the end of January and early February, but so I would have, like, Coach Yurick would say, hey, take as long as you want before you get out to practice with us. And I'd be out there the next day. I didn't want to lose a spot, you know? Yeah. So when hockey ended, so that was tough the winter to spring. But I think that putting the lacrosse stick down for a little bit made you that much more hungry when you picked it up, as opposed to having it in your hand all year. You know, but the skill level with which these guys are playing now is different, right, Jack? It's incredible, you know, how talented and skillful they are. Whereas back in our day, Jack, maybe it was, if you were just a better athlete, you could run through people a little bit more, you know? So I don't know the answer. I'd like to think so. And, you know, my son at Skinny Atlas High School is a good little player as a sophomore, and he's playing 3 sports. And I just think the experience of playing with your high school buddies and the experience of playing hockey at Skinny Atlas High School or winning the state championship this fall as a soccer player, you can't look past how meaningful that is when you get to be old guys like us, right, Jack? The experience and the friendships and everything that you go. It's not playing to get recruited. It's playing because you love the game.
How did you go from being a head coach at Randolph-Macon to your next D1 position as a assistant at UPenn? Like, how did that process work for you?
Well, you know, I remember when I decided to get into coaching, I was interviewing down at Wall Street, like a lot of the guys back in that time and to this day. And I remember telling my father, you know, I'm going to get into coaching. And he's a pretty mild mannered guy. He said, what the heck are you talking about? But I decided to go down to Randolph-Macon and, you know, make next to nothing. You know, but they gave me a room and they gave me lunch in the cafeteria. You know, I got thrown into that. You know, I was an assistant coach there in a great league, the ODAC, right? With Roanoke and Washington and Lee and those, you know, Lynchburg, and it's a great league, and Hampton Sydney. And so we did pretty well, and I was the assistant. And then the head coach became the head football coach at Randolph-Macon. And he went to the AD and said, this guy's ready. So I was 23 and I was a head coach in the ODAC. No business being a head coach looking back, you know, but did okay. We did pretty well. We had a couple year run that we did, you know, the best that program had ever done. And then Terry Corcoran had just left Washington College to go to UPenn. So I knew Terry through Hobart and working camps in the summertime, which Jack, right? You said that San Diego camp that I did in 1991 with you. You know, we can't tell the stories from that one. That was such a great week out there. It was unbelievable. Yeah. We had so much fun. It was, and that's where I met you. It was awesome. But you know, Terry called me, you know, late in the summer and said, hey, I want you to come be my assistant at UPenn. And that's when I went there. And his tenure there wasn't long. That wasn't the place for him. It just wasn't a great fit for him. And so I wasn't there long, but certainly learned a ton going to UPenn and being in the Ivy League. And that was a huge stepping point for me.
I'm always curious when coaches go start at a D3 level and go D1. And actually, you went back to D3 after that. You went to Alfred.
Yeah. Right.
And then you ended up going to Georgetown, coaching with your former head coach when you were a player, and Urich, yep. Right?
He's everything to me. He's my mentor. Just an incredible person, and obviously his record speaks for itself. One of the greatest coaches to ever coach the game, and just kept it in perspective, Kyle. Like I listened to your talk with the MIT coach, and what a great job he's doing there. It's really fun to look at that and see what he's doing. But when you said something, Kyle, you said, you know, Springfield and Cortland are the two places that have produced so many coaches. It's very, very true. But you got to put Hobart in that list, my friend. There's a lot of really good coaches out there that came through Hobart. You know, Frank Fediaca at Bucknell and Tommy Gervonta down at Mount St. Mary's and Mark Van Arsdale, who's been, you know, one of the best offensive minds in the game. A lot of guys came through Hobart as well, you know.
That's why we had you on, Coach, today to let us know all the great coaches.
I got a fact check, Kyle.
Listen, I didn't know we were teaming up against Kyle Day, but that's fine. And I'm sure. Listen, if BJ O'Hara listened to podcasts, he would have already fed it to me 10 times over.
Absolutely,
we got to get him off the flip phone. And he would be all over me. So
yeah, BJ was my coach my senior year, because Coach Urich went to Georgetown to build that program right before my senior season at Hobart. So BJ was my coach that year. We had a heck of a team in 1990, and learned a lot from BJ.
And
for
it's,
sure,
it's funny because, like, you know, it actually ties into kind of your current job in a way. I mean, I know BJ from his time coaching in the MLL. And now you are an assistant with the PLL Chrome, and you're actually taking this Zoom call in Tim Sudan's office.
I am. I'm up in God's country this week. I live in Tampa now. But I'm up here watching my son play a little bit and just getting with my two sons, and wanted to meet up with Sudo and Jacques. And I drove over to Fairport this morning. We've been meeting this morning, and it's hard for me as an Irondequoit guy to be sitting in this Fairport Red Raider office right now and seeing a lot of the trophies that were won against me when I was at Irondequoit. But Timmy's the best, and Jacques, and we're just going to have such a good time this summer coaching some of the best guys in the country,
yeah, you in said, the world. You right? said you were there, and Jack and I just went, Sudo! like at the same time, because you know we both have a relationship with him as well. And I this is one of my favorite things about lacrosse is that everybody kind of knows everybody, or someone knows someone that knows somebody that you're close with. It's one of the best things. I love having that be part of a podcast, and you know, a lot of the stories maybe we can't tell on the podcast. But I know that if you're coaching with Sudo, you're going to have a great time.
It's a fraternity, right? And everybody, you'll bang heads and try to beat the heck out of each other. And then afterward, you're hanging out and keeping it in perspective, right? That's why lacrosse is such a unique sport and why we all love it so much, right, Kyle? It's just different. It's just different. It's hard for people to understand unless you're in it, you know, but it's amazing.
Can't get enough.
Coach, you talked about when you started off, and so many coaches, even today, Division III, Division I, assistant coaches don't make any money. They're working the camp circuit all summer long and, you know, trying to make it like you did and get to that next level, Georgetown, so on and so forth, all the way up to Cornell and now the PLL. This experience for you is going to be very different in some ways. I mean, you were a great player in the MLL. You were an all-star. Played 91-96, but what's going to be a little different for you as the offensive coordinator, coaching this group of players, and what are you looking forward to?
Yeah, you know, first of all, I've been so impressed with the PLL and the way that they've built it and the professionalism of it. You know, I think it is the real deal. And so I'm just eager to work with the best players in the world, right? So I don't think you certainly can't overcoach it. It's not like the NFL or the NHL, you know, where you're together all week. You know, it's a little bit different, right? You get together on a Friday, have practice before a Saturday game. But I also think that you can do so much more now with these Zoom calls and the ability to connect. And that's the one reason why I'm really eager to work with Tim and Jacques. You know, I've always kind of stood back and really been impressed with the way they build the culture of the programs that they run, you know, with the Rattlers and now with the Chrome. You can never look past the importance of that, right? I mean, talent doesn't win you championships, right? It's a combination of a lot of things. And I think Timmy and Jacques do such a good job of that. So really excited to work with them and just kind of build on the culture that they've established with these guys. And I don't care what level you're at, right, Jack, Kyle, like you're playing at the top of lacrosse. They still want to be coached, right? These guys want to be coached and they want to learn and grow and have direction. And that's why they're playing at this level, because they're eager to continue to grow, right? So I'm looking forward to being with these guys.
I couldn't agree with you more in terms of players wanting to be coached at every level, but culture is so important, and you're the perfect example of being in a great culture, winning four national championships. And culture ends up winning out no matter what level you are, and toxic teams, you know, drama, you see it in a number of other professional sports, doesn't win out. And I think that's one of the special things about lacrosse is, generally speaking, in terms of a fraternity, it's a great culture to be in.
Yeah, I agree. And it's, again, it is unique, and you'll compete to the bitter end, but you're also very close and very tight as a group, and it bonds you together, right? I mean, it's a creator's game. I grew up in Irondequoit, New York, and, you know, played on the reservations a lot growing up and played a lot of box. And, you know, I've learned to appreciate the meaning of this, what this game is, right? And so it is very unique. And, you know, the cultural piece, I know I won four as a player. That's easy. I wish I could have won a couple as a coach. We're very close a couple times. Georgetown and Cornell being in Final Four games, that looking back, you know, so I'm eager to get that championship at the highest level this summer with a great group and with the Chrome.
Coach, as the offensive coordinator for the Chrome, Obviously, you've got some returning players, very talented players. Can you talk about what you like about the players that you have on offense? Will you change anything they did last year with these players? What kind of players you're looking for? And what kind of offense are you planning to run with this group?
Yeah, it's interesting. The more that I've met with Tim about the offensive side of it, you know, and we're going to meet a lot more over the next month, but it's challenging. It's a quick shot clock, right? It's pretty quick. It was at 60 seconds or 58, whatever it is.
It's 52, coach. Get your facts straight. You're the coach over there.
Yeah, but I better learn that, right? But it is very quick. So there's not a lot of time to set things up and try to run set plays at all. You have to read and react, and the early offensive piece is really important from defense to offense. And the interesting piece with us right now at Chrome is we've the guys that have built the culture here. There's still a number of them that are a part of this, but we've had a few guys that just retired. Right, you look at it. John Galloway is a huge piece to the culture that Sudo tried to establish and did establish, and Joel White and Jordan Wolf, right? Those are all guys that were a huge piece of this for a while, and they've all retired, right? So we're kind of I wouldn't say rebuilding, but kind of a revamp a little bit of who's going to take the leadership roles. And, you know, we have McIntosh, who I know they think really highly of, and we have Jesse Bernhard defensively that is as tough as it comes and a great leader, and Rannigan on offense. And so we're going to look to kind of pass the torch to some of these guys that have learned from the guys that I just talked about that retired. Right. So we have the number one pick, you know, we'll see where that goes. You know, obviously most people are talking about, you know, Chris Gray down at North Carolina, and we'll see, but you know, he's going to, if it is him, then, you know, he's going to have to take a quarterbacking role of the offense. So we'll see what the pieces are once we get to training camp in a month. And I'm just eager, no matter who it is, who we're going to be working with.
Yeah, you also had Ned Crotty and Matt Danowski retiring.
Yeah.
Also part of that.
Yeah, Ned, yeah. I meant to mention, you know, Ned. So, yeah, it's a lot of and this is lacrosse is a young man's game, right, Jack? We try to go up to Lake Placid and still jog around. I wouldn't say run. Jog around up there, but this is a young man's game, and the level of play, you know, with Johnny and Brian being at Cornell, you know, the fitness level and the strength piece of it now, and what these guys do, it's hard to play much past 28, 29, 30 years old for these guys, because it is full go, and it's pretty intense and pretty physical. So it's a young man's game, and we're looking forward to putting our best group out there that we can hopefully win a championship with.
New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal will return after this message.
The Men's Lacrosse Championships, where speed and power meets precision and creativity. And they give it everything they got, from face-off to the final whistle. Go big for every goal. Go beyond your limits and enter the NCAA universe. The Men's Lacrosse Championships, May 28th through 30th at Rentschler Field in East Hartford, Connecticut. Get your seats today at ncaa.com/mlacrosse.
Are you serious about playing your sport in college? Do you need a flexible education that allows you to maintain your practice and competition schedules while also preparing you to succeed at the next level? You should check out the University of Nebraska High School. UNHS is accredited and offers more than 100 online courses, including NCAA-approved courses to protect your academic eligibility. Students could earn a UNHS diploma or take a single course for transfer credit. Courses are college prep, self-paced, and available 24/7, 365. Enroll anytime and take up to a year to complete a course. Visit highschool.nebraska.edu today.
Looking to keep up with all the latest news and information on New England lacrosse? New England Lacrosse Journal and LaxJournal.com are the premier resources for information and inspiration on the New England lacrosse scene. Have every issue of New England Lacrosse Journal, the magazine, delivered to your home or office. And don't forget to stay in the game every day with a digital subscription to LaxJournal.com to receive daily digital lacrosse coverage on club lacrosse, college commits, prep and high school, Division I, II, and III colleges, showcases, rankings, and much more. Get in the game and behind the scenes now by logging on to LaxJournal.com. Just click on the subscribe button and start the subscription that is right for you today. New England Lacrosse Journal is a Siemens Media publication. Siemens Media. Inspiring. Informative. Insightful.
Coach, we're kind of in my wheelhouse, as it were. I don't do too much pro coverage these days, but I have a relationship with most of the coaches in the PLL from my time covering MLL for, I guess, till it was done. from the start till it was done, kind of where I cut my teeth in lacrosse writing and coverage. And I got to say, like, the Chrome didn't have the best record last year, but they didn't lead the league in text to me about unhappy players. So that's why I love Sudo, right? Like, I when he took over that team, the team had to acquire a lot of his guys. And they were already there, but they made some moves to get guys like that. And now you have kind of a fresh palette. We haven't seen Tim Sudan coach a team that's been not his guys for a while. And he's still got some on this team, but the draft, you mentioned it. This is a huge draft for you guys. Absolutely huge. And the thing about this draft class is that it's going to reward the teams that draft well, not the teams that just draft guys. Because, as you know, the PLL is just so stacked with talent at pretty much every position. So, obviously, you know, let's hypothetically say you take Chris Gray, number one. I'm not saying you do. But your next pick is in the second round, pick number 9.
Yeah.
You've got starters, starting roles to fill almost everywhere. As the offensive coordinator, what kind of player are you looking for in the 9 slot?
It is about the needs. I think the one thing in talking to Jacques in particular, and Jacques and I are as close as can be, you know, we were teammates at Hobart together and coached our way up through the ranks together. So we spent a lot of time together in the summer camps and all that stuff. But anyway, in talking to him, it's you don't go real deep in the draft, right? I think we only have like 4 picks, right? So, you know, it's not like you can draft 7 guys, you know, and then see how they pan out. It's you really have to do a great job with each pick. And he mentioned one thing to me that rang true. It's like, yeah, of course, if you really need a long stick, maybe they can get the ball up off the ground, or you have to get a goalie, then you need to take that with that second pick, right? But I'm not sure exactly what we're going to do or what direction we have to feel like we need to go with that pick. But it's hard to pass up on a true kind of proven offensive talent, either a midi or an attack, right? It's tough to pass that up because there's a lot of similar type guys that maybe play on the defensive end, you know, that if there's a defenseman that is, you know, a clear Brody Merrill type guy, then you take him, right? But I don't know if there is that type of guy there right now. So it's probably going to be another offensive talent with our second pick. But again, it depends on how the thing plays out. And, you know, if there's a T.D. Erland type of faceoff guy, do you need to take it with that second pick if he's still available? So there's a lot of ifs, right, Kyle? But I think it's hard to pass up somebody that you think can make an impact on the score sheet for you with that second pick.
Yeah, I think to that end, how challenging is it for you as a coach to find out which one of these players is going back to school? Because I know now, I know for a fact, I'm not going to say which teams, but there are D1 teams, coaches of D1 teams, offering extra grad years to players that are eligible and can't go back to their school, right? Because of either league rules or something like that. So there, all these players have extra eligibility. Do you have to individually contact the players, or can you just talk to the coaches, or what is your process for that?
Yeah, that's been in Jack, you probably are firsthand knowledge of some of this stuff, right? In the Ivy League, talking to your boys, right? I mean, there's a lot of guys that are in the Ivy League in particular that are really good players that have another year of eligibility because the Ivy didn't play last year, you know, but can't go back to those Ivy schools, right? So, you know, you're going to see the rich get richer, right? The Dukes and UNCs and Virginias of the world are going to, you know, Maryland are going to add really established guys from those leagues that, you know, from the Ivy League in particular, and maybe a NESCAC kid or whatever it might be that can step right in and play. So you're right, Kyle. It's we don't know. You know, we're calling college coaches daily right now and asking them about a specific player. Is he coming back to play for you, or does he want to come play pro? Right. And so we're using the coaches first, obviously. And then they're declaring right now if they want to be in the draft, right? The college guys, I think the list just came out and they're still kind of finalizing it. So we're finding out that way through the league and through players themselves, student athletes declaring for the draft. And then we're talking to their college coaches and just trying to piece it together, because there's a lot of guys like that right now that have, you think they're coming out, but they still have a year to use if they want to.
Coach, when is the draft?
It's right. It's like the end of the month, right?
It's Mother's Day, I think. You can be drafted, and if you go back to school or don't play that summer, you go back in the pool, right? So like Jeff Teat did that. And you know, PLO rules are kind of rolling with stuff like that. They do what they can to make that the most interesting possible, which is frustrating as someone that used to cover it and covers it kind of less fully. But I think, you know, for perspective, like, you always want to get players, like you were saying, that are impact players. You know, those first two picks that you have, 1 and 9, you know, I think you're one of the only teams that has attack slots open, or at least competitive. Like, you don't have 10-year veterans playing attack. You have a couple guys that go both ways. You know, you've got Colin Heacock, who's also can also play midfield. Jackson Morrow was the guy last year, kind of took over that QB role when Jordan Wolf got hurt. And you do technically have Dylan Malloy on the roster from what I'm looking at, but I don't know if that's, you know, players are also in this point still signing their deals to play this summer. Do you have any kind of involvement with that in your job right now as an assistant?
No, not really. You know, that falls on Tim and Jock and, you know, guys that have a really good handle with the conversations they've had with the players that played last year. Right. So, you know, we're diving into it more. I really just signed on the dotted line, you know, fairly recently. And so we're diving into responsibilities and what we're going to be doing logistically and the whole thing. Right. So it's exciting for me. Always exciting trying to build a program and build a team and, you know, all the pieces that go into that and establishing that with the current members of the team and the potential of who we're going to get, who's on waivers and who's out there still. And, you know, it was interesting. I threw out to these guys on a Zoom call last week, you know, about Ryan Gebhardt, you know, at MIT. I know the family really well. I know his dad very well. It's a great lacrosse family, Central New York guy. And I remember talking to the young man when I was coaching Cornell. He was a little bugger coming out of Baldwinsville. And to see what he's done over the last 5 years or 4 years is just amazing. And, you know, I don't know if he could translate to play and make the jump to play at this level, but he certainly has produced. And like you said, Kyle, I'm a D3 guy. So it would be an awesome story for someone like that to be able to make the jump and play at this level. So there's so many talented young men out there that hopefully we're going to be able to really look at all of them, right? As many as we can to give them an opportunity in this league, which I think is phenomenal. This league is very professional. It's the level of play is obvious, and super excited to be a part of it.
And they have some of the best officials, and Matt Pelham, and you know,
that's right,
yeah, Matty P. Yeah. The 52nd shot clock will be an adjustment for you because you've never coached with a shot clock, correct? Because back when you, I think your last year at Cornell, that was just
a stall.
And yeah, so not only is it new to you, it's 52 seconds. College is 80. It's really 60 when you get over the midfield line. But, you know, we can debate that too. But what about coaching with a field that is 10 yards shorter? Have you thought about that?
Yeah, you know, it's one, the shot clock, I don't think is going to be any issue for me. I think anybody that knows me and saw the teams that I coached over the years, that's not an issue.
You like to push the ball.
We like to push. We like to shoot getting off the bus. So I don't mind that at all. I think that'll be an easy adjustment for me. But, yeah, the field, you know, with the size of it, you know, the just the athleticism that these guys have, it's you know, I watched as much of it as I could the last two summers. I just truly enjoy watching the game and really enjoyed that game in particular. The PLL, I think, is doing it the right way. And, you know, shot clock, that seems a little bit short to me. It's tough to even, like, set up offensively at times. You know, if you don't get it up and out of your defensive end really quickly, you're going to be up against that clock pretty quick, right? But I don't think there'll be any adjustment to that. And as you know, Jack, we're hockey guys at heart, right? I mean, you play on different size rinks all the time, right? So you just have to adjust and adapt to whatever the circumstances are.
Having watched a number of games myself, what I caught watching the games was turnovers on the offensive end, where the turnovers, you know, happened close to the goal, behind the goal. It's like, I guess, in Division I men's and 3-2, whatever, call it, collegiate lacrosse, men's and women's. You know, we always want to lose the ball behind the goal, goal line extended. You don't want to lose the ball in the middle of the field. But I found in the PLL, if they turn the ball over, you know, over midfield or 10 yards in midfield, it was like a death trap because that ball got off the ground. That guy got the ball every single time off the ground, bing, bing, bang, and your defense doesn't have time to react. In the 10-yard larger field Division I men's game, I think you got a little more time. You don't see as many fast breaks in Division I lacrosse now as I'd like to see, but I think that really creates a lot of excitement with the shorter field and greater risk by losing the ball inside the midfield line versus at the collegiate level.
Turnovers are it's part of the game. It's, you know, lacrosse is a game of mistakes, and you want to minimize those mistakes. But, you know, if you're turning the ball over, trying to jam it into the crease a little bit here and there, that's fine, right? But if you have a sloppy turnover, like you said, up top, you know, near the 2-point line or whatever it is, the athleticism that you're seeing of these short stick D middies and the long poles, that's trouble, right? So, you know, you just have to minimize that. And you know, I'm eager to see, you know, how often I think the short stick D middie role is everything these days, right?
You said something there that I tend to usually disagree with, but I get the context you're using it. You said lacrosse is a game of mistakes. That's what I call soccer. You know, when I talk to people, I'm like, no. Lacrosse is a game where offense wins the game, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's the defense's job to make it difficult. But for me, I've always been, you know, and I wasn't always like this. I started as a defensive coach and kind of then became an offensive coach when I, you know, I'm an attackman. So I'm always looking for ways to get shots. And the difference between players now, especially in the PLL, is like everyone can create their shot, especially against a short stick. So really the onus is on the defense to adjust, right? So I just wanted to drill down on lacrosse being a game of mistakes. Can you elaborate on that a little bit more? Like what is your,
you know, that's definitely a coach Yurk term, you know. Okay. He didn't dwell on You need to hold the ball. You need to not take a chance, right? I think that's more what I mean, Kyle, right? It's okay to, you know, somebody back cuts their defenseman 30 yards down the field, and you want to make that play as a midfielder and try to hit that guy in stride, you know, the risk and reward there. But it's more about not dwelling on that, right? It's more about, okay, I just made a foolish pass trying to throw it to my attackman 35 yards away. Even though he was open, I couldn't get it there. It's more, how do I react to that? How do I get the ball back in the ride? How do I make a play following that play, and not, you know, putting my palms up or letting my head go down a little bit because I'm disappointed in the play I just made, right? And that's, I think, more what I mean, Kyle, right? It's more about it's okay to make aggressive mistakes, I guess, is what I would say. So if you're going to make an aggressive play to the cage and try to, you know, Jackson Morrill's trying to feed, you know, McIntosh up top, cutting down the backside, I'm fine with that, right? As an offensive coach, right? It's being lazy or being hesitant or being selfish with the ball. Those are the mistakes that you can't accept as a coach. So I think that's probably more what I'm saying. You know, and mistakes are going to happen. Guys going to miss a ground ball here or there. How are we going to make sure that doesn't impact the outcome of a game? And that's what I mean with being game mistakes. It's how we respond and how we make the next play.
Well, first of all, I'm totally going to steal that and use it today at practice. So thank you.
Very good.
I appreciate that. And then kind of secondly, you know, the thing about the PLL that, to Jack's question, the loss of the 10 yards, right? I don't like it. And here's why I don't like it. Teams have started to drop earlier to kill the break. And sure. I think lacrosse, the greatest play in lacrosse to me is the 3 or 4 pass fast break. It is gorgeous. It is beautiful. Jack is actually agreeing with me. I want this on video. Saf, make sure we get this on video. Jack is nodding his head and agreeing with me.
It's the funnest thing in sport to watch is a fast break.
It's unbelievable. And I guess my follow-up question is, like, how are you going to manufacture fast breaks?
I don't think you can. You can't manufacture it, right? I think you're exactly right. I mean, it is the greatest thing. It is a thing of beauty to see, right? But if you look at most 4-on-3s that actually happen, they're coming from the side of the box, right? Or on an angle. They're not coming like we used to run them in practice.
Straight down the middle of the field.
Straight up 4-on-3s going back and forth, right? They don't happen as much because as a defensive coach and an emphasis of defense, like you are, you're like, we can't give those up, right? Because it's too easy for the attack to score.
Right.
Right. So it's hard that you can't really manufacture them. I think the key is in watching a lot of college games right now, and Jack, you know, I have a lot of vested interest in watching Cornell play right now. With a lot of the young men that are still there
that you recruited,
that was a part of the recruiting piece too, and you know, I think there's so many times where they have a 5-on-4 or a 6-on-5, and they've got some very strong short stick D middies that are running, but they don't seem to look for that break. It doesn't look like they have the green light, you know what I mean, as an offensive group. To do that. So if the ball comes down to John and he's got one of those trailing middies coming, you want to really be sure if he's going to throw that to the trailing middy and let's go after it, you know, but that's something you just have to rep and practice and do, right? And you have to have trust in your touristic D middies that they're going to make a good play with that. And you're going to be facing off afterward, right? So, but I think to get to that step of going to the Final Four and winning a national title, if you look at UVA and you look at Maryland, you look at the teams that obviously spend a lot of time doing it, they make you pay with those plays, right? Because those are kind of easy goals, right? It ends up being a 2-on-1 on the backside, and you have to, you've got to get 4 or 5 of those a game. Maybe one's a fast, pure 4-on-3 fast break, and then there's 3 or 4 5-on-4s and you know, a bunch of 6-on-5s that if you can capitalize on those and get 4 or 5 of those goals a game, you can play late into May, right?
Yeah, Coach, I couldn't agree more. And what you're saying is, especially at the PLL level and even at the college level, you see less opportunities to run those 5-on-4, 6-on-5s, 4-on-3s.
Yep.
You got to take them. And the PLL, you got to take them. You got them. You got a 6-on-5. You got a 5-on-4, 3-on-2. You got to take them. You got to push the ball. And back to what you were saying, you might make some mistakes. But the risk and reward is greater in the PLL because the games are shorter, the clock's shorter, the field's shorter. So you're going to have less opportunities. And when you do, you got to push and go for it. Correct?
It's hard to score 6-on-6 at the highest level, right? It's defensively, you know, those guys are a machine in terms of their slide packages and their support of each other and just the one-on-one matchups that they can handle, right? It's hard to score 6-on-6 at the highest level of Division I and at the MLL, you know, PLL highest level, right? So you have to bang a few of those transition, take some chances and hopefully you're handling the ball really well.
And whoever handles the ball at the end can put it in the cage. Coach,
being
the offensive coordinator, give me one play, man up play. Say 6-on-6 is very difficult to score. What are you thinking about man up? What are you thinking?
He's going to run the Duke man up. Do it. Say it.
Never. I'm going to run stuff that I've run forever.
Well, how many plays do you have in your pocket for man up? 4, 3, 4?
A lot more than that. For sure. You know, I used to put one new one in every week, right? So, you know, it's one of my favorite parts of the game for sure. I really enjoy it. And when you get to this level, you can do a lot of interesting things, you know, some hidden ball type stuff, you know, some fake flips to kind of kick off the man up and go for that quick hit. And then it's just about finding the set that you're best in, right? So it was always for me just running a quick play real early in the man up where the first 10 seconds, hopefully you're just going to cash in and get a really simple look off of a seal and a pick or a, you know, some movement off the ball, or like I said, a hidden ball or a, you know, some flips maybe going on that you find a quick hit, and then you just get into that set that you're best out of as a group and just get the ball hopping. You have one more than they do. It's not very complicated, right?
Do you prefer a guy at X or do you prefer all the guys in front of the goal?
Yeah, I do like a guy at X, and you got to have the right personnel, right? So I've been fortunate to have some great ones as a coach, you know, obviously with Rob at Cornell and Greg McCavra and Steve Dussault and those guys I had at Georgetown, and Daryl Veltman I had at Hobart. You know, those are guys that make your man up look really good, right? So I like having a guy behind the goal, but it's also great to have 6 guys above where everybody's a threat. So it depends.
One of the great things about the PLL is that it's not regional, and fans can pick whatever team they like. So I'm going to give you the platform on the podcast. Why should people pick the Chrome as their favorite team?
Well, outside of probably the physically strongest staff on the sideline.
And best looking.
You can tell Coach Towers I said that. If you want a group that is going to be playing really hard for one another, I'd like to think that we're going to be, you know, the best at it in the league. I know that every team can say that, but I'd like to think with the way that Tim, Coach Monty, and Coach Suda have established that is our number one thing here. It's a great team to watch that way, very unselfish group, and, you know, we're going to play really hard. I guarantee that.
Jack, any parting words?
Coach, congratulations on your marriage.
Yeah, it's been a great couple of weeks for me, Jack. I got to get back to reality here.
We want to thank you again for listening to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast. For Jack Piattelli, I'm Kyle Devitt, and we want to thank our producer, Steve Safran. We'll see you next time.
You've been listening to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Spotify, TuneIn, Stitcher, and other podcast platforms. Also, listen to the podcast on the website, laxjournal.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at NELaxJournal, Instagram at New England Lacrosse Journal, Lax Journal on Facebook, and our email address, chasingthegoal@laxjournal.com. Join us again next time as we go chasing the goal. Chasing the Goal, a Siemens Media podcast.